Dallas versus Ellis, and I apologize for the delay. As such, on behalf of the appellant, Ronald Swofford will be arguing, and on behalf of the respondent, Brian Zollinger. And can both parties see the timer?
Yes.
Yes.
Very well. Are there any preliminary matters?
I have none.
All right. You may proceed, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. May it please the court. Thank you for this time you will spend hearing my argument. I'm going to first perhaps give kind of a bullet point description or summary of what I believe is on the facts that each party agrees to. Of course, this was a divorce case, and the intervenor, Mr. Denny, was appointed a receiver and forensic accountant in August of 2013. The court specifically limited his accounting fees to $10,000 in the original order, which is undisputed. The accounting, forensic accounting, there were hearings. It was never admitted into evidence due to some problems and errors and omissions. As of January of 2014, Mr. Denny had removed $10,000 from a reserve account of the parties. And as of that date in 2014 in January, he requested an additional $7,637.80. He was discharged on that date also on January 28th by the order of the court and granted another $7,637 in fees at that time. The footnote in that order specifically indicates in that order of January 28th of 14 that his forensic services bill was $6,293 that juncture on that date, and his receivership bill was $11,344. The problem comes in the summary judgment hearing on the transcript, page 109, which occurred on December 2015. Mr. Denny admitted that he performed no receivership duties, received no income from the parties, and he paid no debts, left that to the parties. Nevertheless, at that time, we were unaware of that. On January 28th of 2014, the court ordered the additional sum to be paid, which amounted to essentially a total of $17,537.80, half of which was paid by $10,000 previously paid, and half of the remaining $7,537 was paid by each party as required by the court within 10 days of the order. Mr. Denny waited 15 months until June of 2015 to file his petition to intervene. This is 15 months after the divorce was closed on February 4th of 2014. So for some reason, at that time, he said, indicates that the amount he submitted was incorrect 15 months earlier. He asked for intervention in a closed case that had been closed for 15 months and asked the court to consider adding another $5,000 to that amount. At that point, there was the intervenor filed a motion for summary judgment, and that was heard first by Judge Blower in December of 2015, and he simply indicated that that the intervener was to be paid an amount owed as of January 28th of 2014, but did not determine the amount and indicated that there was to be a hearing. The order specifically said Mr. Ellis was required to pay whatever amount was owing to Mr. Denny as of 1/28/14, and goes from there. The trial on this matter was set and unfortunately assigned to a third magistrate, who heard this, who knew little, if anything, about the case, naturally, as a lot of time had gone by, and they were to hear the issue on the amount of fee, the amount. Basically, at that point, the court affirmed the amount, and granted fees and costs in addition. I'd like to address first the issue of intervention. I believe that waiting 15 months after the entry of a decree of divorce and intervening in a closed case is inappropriate. I don't think Rule 24A permits such an intervention. Basically, he did not in his petition file any specific data or facts would suggest why he should have been allowed to intervene, other than saying generally that there were common interests of property or law involved between the parties.
Mr. Swofford?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do have a question about that. It seems the record is missing the transcript of the hearing wherein the court made his discretionary ruling. And in such a case, we're required to presume that the record supports the ruling. Do you have any indication as to what was ruled and when during that hearing, or where in the record we can look to the rationale of the judge making a discretionary decision?
I was my understanding that my the attorney who handled out at the time in my office augmented the record with that. I can point that out specifically. It was January 8th, 2016. This was an order by Judge Bowler, magistrate at the time. It's referred to in the transcript on page 207. The quote is that Mr. Ellis was required to pay whatever amount was owing to Mr. Dandy as of January 28, 2014. I apologize. I thought there was augmented by the in a record subsequent. Essentially, with regard to the intervention,
I'm sorry, Mr. Swofford. I'm still unclear. Is the transcript of the motion to intervene hearing part of the augmented record?
I thought it was, but I am not positive. I'd have to check that.
Okay, so what was it that you were just reading from, the quote?
I apologize. That was an order issued by Judge Blower on the initial motions for summary judgment on the intervention claim for additional fees claimed by Mr. Denny, the intervener at the time.
Okay, thank you.
It was the first hearing where he said essentially whatever amount was owed, I owed at that date is owed.
Before you get going again, Mr. Swofford, I had another question. Does it change the analysis of this issue from your perspective at all, the fact that this intervener was actually appointed to serve as a master in the case? Well, this isn't somebody that just kind of came out of nowhere. This was a person that was involved because they were ordered to be a master.
Yes, I don't think it does. I mean, I don't think it changes anything. The reason I say that is because irrespective, he submitted an invoice to the court, which is referred to in the court's order of January 28, 2014, footnote 2, which specifically says that he was seeking fees for a receivership of $6,293, I'm sorry, forensic accounting of $6,293, and for receivership of $11,344. And that was the basis under which the judge at the time issued the original pending magistrate in the divorce action issued the order for a total of $17,637. Unfortunately,
Mr. Swofford, the order issued by the judge doesn't say $17,637.80. It says everything that's owed. And one of our members eschews the use of footnotes, and I'm starting to appreciate her position more now. But the order itself says whatever's owed. And didn't the judge conclude that the $21,000 was the total that had been incurred by Denny?
I understand that, but I believe the law of the case and the amount that was submitted for payment on the day of discharge should be the amount that we were looking at, not something that he determined 15 months later. And especially when we learned, and it's in the record I've referred to, that he performed no receivership duties, admitted, and yet charged $11,344 for those duties, which was never really addressed by the court.
And your client never challenged the award of those costs at the time that they were awarded.
We were unaware that he had not, I was unaware that he had not performed any receivership functions, or what the attorney in charge was not. And we learned that in the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, which I've referred to in the page I provided, where he admitted on page 104 of the transcript that he had received no income, paid no debts, and actually performed no functions as a receiver. So that's when we learned of that at that time, and it was we didn't realize that $11,344 was wrongfully paid.
Did your client? Did you not receive a copy of the receiver's report to the judge?
I cannot remember from 2014, but I presume we did. But we were not aware that he didn't perform any duties, or I was, our office was not aware he didn't perform any duties for either party until he pursued the additional amount. We learned that at the summary judgment hearing.
Yeah, but how could your client not know that the receiver never took hold of any of the income or expenses of he and his wife?
I don't know if he understood what receivership really meant, and I don't know that he understood. It's all I can say. My complaint is that he collected $11,344, which was never earned. I'll leave the issue of the...
But before you leave there, I want to talk about closure of the case and what that means. Is there some legal authority that explains what it means when a court closes a case?
Well, I believe there is some. We cited a case in our brief, Paul versus Paul, and there's also a case cited by by the district judge, which I think is more important that he used for authority. That's the case of. That's Wilkinson v. Washington Trust, and he also cites the court, the district court cited that as the Delba case, Delba v. Riggs, 11 Idaho 364. And in that case, it talked and discussed about bringing receivers bringing extraordinary or exorbitant claims against the estate, and that's one issue. The other one, I think, is that basically, if a judgment has been entered, there's got to be some finality somewhere to a judgment that's been entered 15 months earlier. And how can an intervener go in and seek to open a divorce case and intervene in a non-pending action? I think by definition, an intervention is something that happens when there's an action pending and the person wants to intervene because they have common interests and common facts and common law involved in the case. I've never seen nor heard of a case where intervention has been permitted in a case that's been closed for 15 months. I can't find any authority for that. So essentially that leaves a case open forever. If he discovers another amount a year or two from now, I guess that maybe he can pursue that again, or anyone can. But with that, there's no closure. My complaint partially is that he should have known that and should have made a claim with the court immediately when he received the January 28th, 2014 order if he disagreed with the amount. By him taking no action for 15 months and then filing an intervention in the closed case, I think that's an inappropriate procedure and sets a bad precedent for closure of cases.
Well, but one thing your factual recitation did not include was the lawsuit that he initiated against your client independent of this case.
Yes, that was dismissed by the court.
Right, but when did, my point is he did take some effort prior to intervening in this case to try and collect this debt.
Yeah, yes, he took some effort, but I don't disagree with that. And I think there are methods by which he could have filed an independent action. I don't think he's permitted to intervene in this case.
But I thought your position in that other case was, in fact, that he should have filed a motion to enforce the court's order in the divorce case.
But
I thought that was the whole basis of your defense.
I think that has to be done timely. If he wants to do that timely within the rules.
What is the time?
I think it's like the other rules too. If you're going to amend it, you have to do it under 60B. Or you've got to do it under a motion to correct or alter an order or a judgment. But I don't think there's any authority permitting an intervention in a closed case 15 months later. I think it has to be done timely. And either, like I said, 60B is the normal procedure, or motion to correct clerical error or to amend a judgment in some way.
But Mr. Swofford? I want to make sure I understand your argument. Is your bigger concern the timing, or do you believe that the fee was not earned?
Both.
Let's talk about the latter then. In reviewing the transcript, there are references that the third judge made to things that the second judge said, maybe even quoting the first judge, who I think was Judge Crowley on this.
Yes.
And I think we've all been involved in divorces before, either as judges or attorneys, and hopefully not as participants.
Hey, wait a second.
I think we all are familiar with cases where the parties, as Judge Crowley said, were fighting over teacups. In this case, I get the impression from the record that all three judges felt like the fee was earned just because of the nature of the way the parties were handling the dispute. It was just unbelievably contentious over minor and petty things, and the fee was well earned. Do you want to respond to that?
Yes, I do. And I understand their thinking in some respects, but if it wasn't for principle, I don't know where we'd be in this world today. And this was principle on the part of my client. To him, it's right is right and wrong is wrong. And if he charged an additional $11,344 for services not permitted, or if he intervenes in the case 15 months later, or tries to do it the wrong methods, first of all, my client doesn't think it's owed. And it's offensive to him. I think that's part of the problem. The courts just looked at it and kind of glossed it over and said, it's a minor thing. It doesn't make that much difference. It was a big case. And so it's not that important. But I don't think anybody looked at it carefully to see if, in fact, how much was owed. And the findings by the magistrate at the determination hearing by Judge Gardner in October of 2016. He didn't make any findings either. He basically said, and I'll quote, the court listened to the testimony, reviewed the affidavits of Mr. Denny and billing statement of Mr. Denny. After hearing all the testimony, I found nothing to lead me to conclude that Mr. Denny did anything but a sincere effort to comply with the court's order, fulfilling his responsibilities as a receiver and a forensic accountant. It does not appear to me that the expenses are out of line with what expenses would be in a case of this nature, and then he found them reasonable. That's a summary, not findings of fact and conclusions of law. Basically, I don't think that satisfies the requirements of findings of fact and conclusions of law as to how he arrived at that figure. Mm-hmm. By saying, taking an eagle's view of this thing, thinking, oh, it looks pretty good to me. But I don't think that's the way it has to be done. And so I think that, again, as you mentioned, I think it was a teacup. And that's not a teacup to my client. I think under the law, he's right in terms of the intervention, the summary judgment, no findings of fact and conclusions of law. I think that, I want to go on the attorney's fees real quickly. Basically, he awarded attorney's fees and sort of the district court on appeal, but neither of them did a 54E3 analysis at all. Neither of them did that. There's 11 factors that needs to be considered, and they weren't. And there are no findings as to those 11 factors. Again, it was considered to be a teacup and too simple, too silly to deal with, I guess. So I think I'll stop at that point and let opposing counsel.
So, Mr. Swafford, could I have a question before you stop? You refer to the amount as $11,000 in dispute, and isn't it really just $2,000 that we're fighting over here? The footnote that you referred to said that Dr. Ellis owed $3,800, and he wrote a check for that, and isn't the $11,000 when split in half and you subtract $3,800, aren't we really talking about roughly $2,000?
I don't think so. That's not my intention to pursue that or make that explanation. Let me try to make it more clear. Basically, he had been paid $10,000. He took $10,000 out on his own. Mr. Denny did out of the reserve accounts. Then in January, when he was discharged, he billed an additional $7,676. And that was granted also at the time of discharge based on his submission of his invoice, which is described in footnote 3, saying that he has $11,344 in receivership fees and $6,396 in forensic fees, totaling $17,676. Of that $17,676, $10 had been paid, and so he wanted an additional $7,600 at the time of discharge. Then 15 months later, he comes back and adds another $5,000 to it. I hope that makes it more clear. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the respondent, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, this is an unusual way and a very interesting way to handle this hearing. I kind of like it. It's a little different. Didn't have to spend the time to drive to Boise and get a hotel, so I appreciate the court's flexibility.
You don't want to spend any more time in Boise than you want to, than you have to, right, Brian?
Correct. Not if I can help it. I appreciate you guys staying over there full time. So I'll begin my argument today with the beginning of our brief. We discussed that we believe that this appeal has not properly been filed and that this court should dismiss the appeal because it's a jurisdictional issue. And that being, still in this case, Mr. Ellis has not filed an appeal from the final judgment. Clearly, in the notice of appeal, he never included a copy of the final judgment he's appealing from because there was no final judgment between Mr. Ellis and the intervener at the time the appeal was filed. The appeal was filed after, just on the summary judgment motion. I think in the reply brief, they've said there was a judgment in the original case, but that was not a judgment between Mr. Ellis and the intervener, Post and Kilpak Denny. And so it's our position today that this court would lack jurisdiction to actually hear this appeal because the proper notice of appeal was not filed. It was filed 6 months before the actual final judgment between these two parties was entered. And clearly under Rule 11, that's a jurisdictional issue. So I've included
Doesn't our rule specifically allow for what's considered a premature filing?
Justice Brody, yes, it does. However, even at that point, they would have to file an amended appeal to include appealing from the final judgment. And the rule clearly also states that they have to attach the final judgment from which they're appealing from, and they have never corrected that issue. There's been no appeal filed where they've mentioned the final judgment or attached a copy of that. So as the appeal now stands, all they've appealed from is a summary judgment motion and other orders that were not after final judgment. So yes, I agree with you on that question. The rules do allow that, but they would have had to file an amended appeal to include an appeal from the final judgment. Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes we, when we don't have a judgment, we will ask the judge to cure that problem so that we can then effectuate an appeal. Isn't that what we should do under these circumstances? I mean, if we say we don't have jurisdiction because there wasn't a final judgment, we're going to send it back, and then you're going to be right back where you were before.
Another excellent question, Justice Degner. The way this is, there has now been a final judgment entered, and so the time for filing that would be improper. Now, they could have sought a 12B6 or a motion, not a 12B6, a motion to declare these orders and the summary judgment appealable, but they didn't do that. And so I think you're right. However, there has now been a final judgment entered, and they didn't file an amended appeal on that. So I think the time for filing a judgment based on an appeal based on that judgment has already lapsed.
Well, now we're back to Justice Brody's question. Isn't a premature application for an appeal moot if there is a judgment that's filed subsequent to the premature motion or appeal?
Thank you, Justice. Yes, I believe that would be the case, but the rules allow them then to file an amended appeal and appeal from that judgment, which they haven't done. Had they done that, I think this appeal would be proper and the court would have jurisdiction over that. But they never filed an amended appeal once that final judgment was entered. And any the cases that I've seen, that's required that they would have to file an amended judgment to appeal from that judgment within the time set out in the rules to file the appeal.
What is the language in Rule 11 that actually requires the amended notice of appeal to be filed?
In Rule 11, let me see, I have Rule 11 here. So Rule 11 simply states any order made after final judgment, including an order denying motion to set aside. Rule 11 doesn't specify that. The only thing Rule 11 then specifies specific to that is that they have to appeal from the final judgment. A copy of the final judgment must be included. So it doesn't really talk about in the rule filing an amended appeal. It just clearly states it's got to be from the final judgment, and that final judgment has to be attached, which hasn't been done. So I think it's an inference. And I thought I had a case in the brief that talks about that. I don't know if it was the Farmers Equipment versus Klinger case that discusses that. I don't have it before me, but clearly under Rule 11, they've never attached a copy of the final judgment. So that would be our argument on this appeal being dismissed. And due to time, I'll move on to my other arguments, but I would like the court to consider that making the decision whether or not this court is with jurisdiction to decide this case. On to the next. As to the motion to intervene being timely, as the questions this court has asked today, there was originally in April 2014 and a separate action brought in Bonneville County to collect this money. In that case, and I put the quotes in there and asked this court to take judicial notice, it sounds like the court as well has read the briefing and looked at that case. In that case, they took the specific position that the proper thing for Post and Kilpak Denny to do was to file a motion in the divorce case to have that enforced. So it's kind of like they're taking contrary positions today, saying we shouldn't have been able to do that. But in the case to have that other case dismissed, that's their exact argument, is the proper way to enforce that judgment was in the divorce case. And so Judge Walker dismissed that case, and we brought the motion to intervene once that was decided. And so really, if there's any timeliness issue, it was caused by the Mr. Ellis's objection to that other motion. I still believe we could have handled it in that other motion. It became a regular collection matter to collect on the court's order. Their argument was that the original judge needed to decide and interpret his own order, which I think is also proper. I think under Rule 70, the courts retain jurisdiction to enforce their judgments and orders, which is what this court did. We simply filed a motion to intervene so that we had standing to argue that.
Mr. Solinger, are you familiar with Rule 71, which was adopted while your case was pending?
Off the top of my head, I am not, Your Honor.
Let me read it to you. It's very short. It says, when an order grants relief for a non-party or may be enforced against a non-party, the procedure for enforcing the order is the same as for a party. Was that rule, I take it from your answer, that rule was never considered during the course of this proceeding?
Justice Brody, it was not. I've got to look at the timeline. So this rule came into effect, it looks like July 1st, 2016. And obviously we had filed our motion to intervene approximately a year before that rule came into effect. And I still believe a motion to intervene would also be a proper procedure to enforce any third party right. The case that I've cited in our briefing is the Farmer versus Boyd case, wherein the court says, in a divorce action, it's proper that property rights involved there and be determined into that, and third parties may be brought in by intervention or otherwise. And so I think whether it's under Rule 70 or a motion to intervene, and even looking at Rule 71, a non-party, the procedure for enforcing the same as any other party, trying to think how that would work if you weren't a party. I guess they would just bring it in trying to enforce a third party contract perhaps into the court.
Or just a motion for enforcement of order.
Perhaps that could also be done. The fact that that rule was put into place a year after the motion to intervene, I don't know how that plays into it, because the law at the time that we brought the motion to intervene was that appeared to be our, since the independent action was dismissed, that appeared to be the only way for my client. Had this rule been in effect in the summer of 2015 when we brought this motion, perhaps we would have moved under this motion and sought enforcement of the court order. But without this rule being in place, Rule 71, that appeared at the time to be the only way to have standing in the case. So we filed the motion to intervene. The court granted the motion to intervene. The motion for summary judgment was simply asking the court to interpret that order. Obviously, what they weren't asking for any more money, anything else. The plain language of that order, we felt like, and the other party, Ms. Ellis in this case, also interpreted the order that to be that way because she paid it. What happened at that hearing is the court clearly said each party to pay half of what is currently owing, and then the footnote, he clearly says, this is what the court's aware of. Well, the reason for that, there were billings in January. I think the last billing date was January 14th, 2014, and this hearing was January 28th, 2014. So those monthly billings had not been submitted, but the court clearly understood that each party would pay half of what was clearly owing. So that's all we asked for, the summary judgment motion. I believe the record is very clear that the judge considered all of those factors, made findings on the record that the order meant what the order said, that each party was to pay half. And the only question after summary judgment was the amount of reasonableness of those fees.
The record in that case is, I'll say somewhat incomplete, gives us an incomplete picture of what happened. And I can't recall which specific document I was looking at, but I had the impression that it was actually the wife who filed a motion for payment of fees to Mr. Denny. Is that correct?
Justice Brody, I don't believe so originally. I think it was she paid her half, and then it was unpaid from January. So in April, we filed our motion, our complaint to collect that in Bonneville County, and that was dismissed. So I'm not aware of in the record where she filed anything to have Mr. Ellis pay that. I could be wrong, but I don't.
Oh no, I took it that it was a motion to the court for payment of the fees by both of them. That this was, you know, long before your involvement in the case.
That could be. I know Mr. Nalder was the attorney for, and he filed as soon as we filed our motion. We dismissed him from the independent action, or Ms. Ellis from the complaint in Bonneville County, and Mr. Nalder withdrew as the attorney. And so that was never an issue in the case since I've been involved in the case. Perhaps prior to that I'm unaware of, I haven't seen that, but that's completely possible before I was involved in the case. And so on the summary judgment, I think Mr. Ellis is incorrect. The judge did consider all of the factors. He found that there were no issues of fact. And in fact, on its face, it's pretty clear that everybody agrees what the material facts were, what was in the court's order. It was clearly an interpretation of law, and that law being the order of the court. And after summary judgment, the court found that the law was clear. There were no disputed issues of material fact. Granted summary judgment on the fact that the court meant what the court said, and each party was to pay half at that time. On the motion for the reasonableness of hearings, they've complained in the brief that there wasn't an appropriate hearing or trial held. If you look at the transcript there, and the transcript at that hearing is over 100 pages long, because what the judge did there was very meticulous. He went through, both parties were able to call witnesses. They had witnesses there that they called. I believe it was a Miss Anderson that worked for Dr. Ellis, took the stand, and she testified. They called her to the stand. That we called Bruce Denny to the stand to testify. After hearing almost an hour and a half of testimony, it's a 100-page transcript, the judge determined very clearly, and it's in our briefing, some of the quotations from there, so the court doesn't have to go back and look at it. I think on pages 21 is some of the court's language, where he says, after hearing all testimony, I find nothing to lead me to the conclusion Mr. Denny did anything but a sincere effort to comply with the court's order and fulfilling his responsibilities as a receiver and forensic accountant. It does not appear to me the expenses are alarming or out of line with the expenses that would be in a case of this nature. And so that the magistrate court, based on his discretion, correctly determined that the fees were reasonable. Based on all the billings that we had submitted, on Mr. Denny's testimony, Mr. Ellis's witnesses' testimony. And so the court did hold an appropriate hearing on the reasonableness of those fees and found that the fees were reasonable, ordered them to pay. And so basically what it appears is Mr. Ellis is now asking this court to second guess the discretion of the magistrate court, where he found the order meant what it did, which I think is pretty clear, and also asking this court to second guess the decision of the magistrate court, where he found the fees were completely reasonable. As to the issue of attorney's fees, the court also made appropriate findings based on my affidavit, the time incurred on this case. Under Rule 20 would be the provision for attorney's fees in any civil action. A demand letter was sent on this. There's no factual dispute about any of that. The amount's under $35,000. The one argument that is interesting is they argue the case under DeLiva versus Riggs, that attorney's fees are not allowed to receivers. That case is a little different because there's also an exception to that rule, that where the receiver employs counsel to defend or enforce a judgment for receiver's fees, they're able to get attorney's fees. And that's what had to happen here. Mr. Denny had to have counsel to enforce his order for attorney's fees. So he's not seeking fees for his own compensation for the allowance of fees. He had to seek counsel to get enforcement of this. So I think there's an exception to the rule that is generally stated in DeLiva versus Riggs that Mr. Ellis has cited. So we believe the magistrate court did act within the bounds of his discretion when he found the order meant what the order meant. He did act within the bounds of his discretion when he found the amounts owing were reasonable. And the court considered the factors in Rule 54 in awarding Mr. Denny attorney's fees as the prevailing party in a civil matter based on the time, labor required, and all of the other factors in 54, which the judge cites both in the record and partially in his order that he did consider those factors. The rule is clear that he doesn't have to outline all of those, but just clarify that he did consider those factors, which he did. And unless any of you have any additional questions, I'll let the rest of my time expire and we can get out of here early.
So Mr. Zollinger, I just had one last question, and that is Poston, Denny, and Kilpack the real party in interest? Because I thought the judge appointed Mr. Denny to be the receiver and the forensic accountant, and I don't remember any suggestion that it was the accounting firm as opposed to Mr. Denny who had been asked by the court to perform those services. And Mr. Denny's affidavit seems to suggest that he was the laboring oar in this endeavor. And I just wondered how it got from Denny being the receiver and the forensic accountant to the firm being the named party?
Let me see if I can find that. It's a, Justice Stegman, that's an excellent question. How that order is originally worded, I don't know that because of insurance and stuff that Mr. Denny would ever do anything outside of the firm, because as an individual, his malpractice insurance or anything wouldn't have covered that. But I have not looked in the record at the specific language of that order. I'll see if I can find that really quickly.
We have that. I think it's at page 263. It says Bruce Denny, CPA, is appointed as receiver.
It's an issue I had not even thought about. Excellent question. What I would say to that is Bruce Denny, again, does not do work outside of his CPA firm for licensing reasons, malpractice reasons. Bruce Denny individually would ultimately be that. I also don't think that's an issue that was raised by the Mr. Ellis, and this is an appeal. So for that reason, I would not believe that it would be appropriate for the court to consider that issue, as they have not raised that on appeal. But that's an interesting question, something I would watch out for in any future case I did with the receiver or forensic accountant, because that's actually a really good point. And I honestly have never looked at the case law to see if there's anything to tie the CPA to the firm that he actually works for. But that's definitely something myself and any judge should probably take notice of in any future case like this. But for today, I would just argue they have not raised that issue on appeal at either level, so it's probably not appropriately before this court, but it's a very good point.
Oh, and with that the motion to intervene, wasn't it brought on behalf of the professional corporation or the PLLC rather than Denny individually, and there was no objection to it on that day? Well, this may go to my first question I asked Mr. Swofford. Is there a copy of the transcript in the record so we know what was stated, what was argued, what was objected to at that very initial stage?
Justice Bevin, another great question. I was scanning the transcript here. I cannot find that in the transcript either. Perhaps Mr. Swofford has found that, but that is correct. I'm not aware of any objection to that when it was originally brought in the name of Post and Kilpak Denny. And it could be something we both overlooked because we've never thought about that issue. When somebody's appointed, if I'm appointed an expert witness in a case, but I only bill through my firm, it's an intriguing point of law that I don't know. I've never thought about that. And it's definitely something you live and learn every day and perhaps in the future. But I think, Justice Bevin, that's an excellent point. There were no objections brought to that in the motion to intervene, that was an incorrect party. So no opportunity to correct that if that were in fact the case. And that now we're further down the line and there's been no objection, no appeal on that issue. So I think the appropriate time to bring that would have been to object at that point in the motion to intervene, which obviously would have allowed us to correct our motion and refile it in a timely manner. But because that wasn't raised, it was never a chance for us to respond to that and even look at that issue. With that, I'll close unless there are further questions.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
8 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir? Thank
you. I want to address first the jurisdictional issue of the appeal. I read Rule 11A7, that's described in the reply brief we filed. I believe that Rule 11A7 talks about appealable judgments and orders, and it defines judgments and orders from which an appeal may be taken. And the quote is specifically, any order made after final judgment and including an order denying a motion to set aside default and so forth. This order was entered after final judgment entry of the decree of divorce, which is entered in February 4th of 2014. This argument is not made below either. This is a new argument on this appeal, but I believe the order 11A7 covers orders and judgments, and not just judgments only. So I believe our appeal is legitimate, and I think it is timely. Our timeline set forth in the reply brief sets forth the order granting the amount of the fees as of 11/17/2016, and the notice of appeal 12/23/16. And then for some reason, 7 or 8 months later, they file a judgment, which I think had no effect or impact upon the finality of that order under 11A7. The intervenor wants to convince this court that this is not this is an enforcement action of an order and not a new action. I would indicate I disagree with that, because they are asking for a new order, a different order than what was entered below. The order below was for a specific amount, and it does not say, footnote 2 to that 128.14 order does not say what the judge was aware of at that time. It set forth an exact specific amount of $17,676. Okay. Now, what the intervener sought to do was modify or change that order, which is a new action. He is not enforcing an order, or he would be enforcing the payment of the $17,676, which he'd already been paid. So it is not a continuation as indicated.
Mr. Swofford, if we interpret the order to be the magistrate court ordering the parties to each pay half of Mr. Denny's bill, is this an enforcement action?
It only if we're enforcing the bill, the amount which was ordered by the court on January 28th, 2014.
I'm saying if we interpret that order to say that the parties are to pay one half of Mr. Denny's bill, no amount specified, one half, is this an enforcement action?
In the sense it is, except there's no amount stated, so it doesn't have any, doesn't accomplish anything in my mind in terms of enforcement. It's a statement, but unless there's an amount set forth, it has no bearing on the finality of the judgment entered earlier.
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay. Just the bare statement, I don't mean bare statement, it's a good question, I'm not saying that. If you consider this, is this an enforcement action if they say, if the court orders that they pay one half of the amount due? Well, it's an enforcement action if you're saying we're enforcing the amount ordered by the trial court. But if they're asking for an additional sum that was determined to be owed after the entry of the final judgment, to me, it's not an enforcement action. It's a new action seeking an additional sum, additional to what was previously determined to be owed, and not an enforcement action. Enforcement means you're enforcing what exists, and a new action means you're creating a new cause of action for a new amount that did not previously exist. And I think they could have filed a motion for reconsideration, timely motion for reconsideration, a 60B motion. Secondly, if they felt that, in fact, the magistrate court improperly dismissed their independent action, they could have appealed that. But I don't think the intervention is the appropriate way to go to intervene on a non-pending case. And again,
what about Rule 71? I mean, the court didn't have a procedure adopted at the time that this motion to intervene was filed. So why shouldn't the court just construe the motion to intervene as a motion to enforce the order?
Well, first of all, we're not enforcing an order. We're asking the court to enter a new order. So if in fact it was, I agree with, if in fact Mr. Denny sought an order to enforce the payment of the $17,637 ordered, that would be an enforcement. If he's seeking a new order with a different amount or a new amount in addition to that, that's not enforcing an order. It's seeking a new order, which I think is the difference to me. And especially, and I want to point out one more thing. Counsel indicated there was an evidentiary hearing, was for summary judgment. I agree there was. But the testimony, which I pointed out, and I pointed to page 104 of the transcript, Mr. Denny admitted under cross-examination with prior counsel in my office, who's no longer with me, but I've studied it on page 104, that he did not do anything as a receiver, collected no income, paid no bills. And that was known to the magistrate judge. He made no findings on that. So essentially, the findings of fact and conclusions of the magistrate's court are deficient. They do not address the intervention. They do not address the amount owed. It just says it looks good to me. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
So Mr. Swafford, I'm now confused. What order is it that you are appealing from?
It's the final judgment order granting the amount of the fees and additional fees on 11-17-2016, called Order Granting Motion for Determination of Reasonableness of Fees on 11-17-16. That was where he said they ordered a new amount of $5,000-some-odd.
And you would agree that that isn't a judgment?
It was an order.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a judgment.
It was not a judgment.
And there's a replacement judgment, a superseding judgment to that order?
I think it's a new order. It's a new order.
Characterized as a judgment?
I'm sorry?
Isn't it characterized as a judgment?
Well, the judge, there was never a judgment issued for the first amount. It was an order. And the second amount was by an order granting summary judgment, which we appealed from. I'm not sure I follow you. I'm sorry.
Is there a subsequent, Mr. Zollinger, I thought was suggesting that there has been a judgment.
Yes. Yes.
That supersedes the order that you just referred to.
Yes, it was entered about 7 or 8 months later after we appealed it.
And there's no suggestion that Dr. Ellis took an appeal from that judgment.
We took an appeal from the order, the final order on that motion on 11-17-16.
And you haven't filed an amended appeal challenging the judgment that was entered subsequent to the order that you're referring to?
No, but I read 11A7 to mean you can appeal any order after judgment.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, I'd like to inquire concerning the procedure used. Mr. Ellis argued in the collection action in front of Judge Walker that Your firm argued that this was not the proper forum. The proper forum was, in fact, the intervention in this divorce case, correct?
Not intervention, but it should be heard by the same pending magistrate who heard the case and knew the evidence.
Why not invoke the issue of judicial estoppel as concerns any argument you have in terms of intervening in this case?
Well, my point was, I think the magistrate who was aware of all of the orders and the work done and the problems with the receivership and the problems with the forensic accounting, who denied its admission into evidence for several reasons, should be the one that makes any ruling on asking for additional fees. And my point was, I believe that had to be done through a motion for reconsideration or a 60B motion, but they cannot wait and do an intervention action on a non-pending case.
Very well. Any further questions by the court? Any further comments, Mr. Swafford?
Just that it's been different for an old geezer like me who started out 46 years ago with a typewriter and 5 carbons. He was postal service, and then at a time when Zoom was the sound a fast car made, this is tough.
It's about time us old duffers got out of the way, Ron.
I know. You're right, too.
All right, this matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision, and thanks to both counsel, and I'm sorry it took me so long to get here. We'll be in recess. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you both again.
Thank you.
Likewise, thank you.